The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is a favorite of this program, Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Welcome back, Jesse. How's it going?
It's going well, Alan. How are you?
Do you love being the face of New York State for the New York Times? I mean, you go to the New York Connection and in the Times in the morning, and there you are.
It is lovely being here. I will say that.
Okay, so Cuomo tells Trump no federal help. I talked to him about this yesterday as we speak, with no help with the violence in New York City. What's going on there?
Well, I think there is a lot of back and forth. And, you know, as you pointed out yesterday or earlier this week, that, you know, there is an issue of us not knowing what is said behind closed doors. The governor says that he had a positive conversation with the president, that the president was receptive to the governor's, you know, pleas that he not send any federal agents into New York City to kind of quell violence and or protest and or crime. But once again, oftentimes Donald Trump will say one thing and make assurances and then change his mind and make a different policy decision. So, the governor, I think, took him at his word and said, look, we can handle it. And the president said, okay, go ahead, you handle it. But, you know, if the situation continues, if it seems like Trump's plan for federal, you know, agents in cities is working either as a public safety measure or, let's be frank, as a political measure, then I think that conversation will probably be rejoined between the governor and the president.
Now, this governor has been consistent in saying he needs money for the state from the feds. Obviously, we've all been watching what's going on in Washington, watching the Republicans argue with each other over all of this. Can you make any sense of what we're going to come out with here?
No, I don't think anyone can. And as you point out, it's not just the governor that's waiting around for federal monies. The legislature is also waiting around. They're in session this week in Albany. And in months prior, there had been some talk that perhaps they'd take up revenue bills, which, for lack of a better word, is taxes or fees. But the legislature itself seems to be waiting to see if they get, saved by federal monies. But those negotiations, I think, are going to go right up to the August recess for the Congress. And I don't think that there has been any indication that the governor is talking directly to Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. And at the end of the day, that will be a critical person to convince that the feds need to spend more to kind of get New York at a hawk.
So what's happening? Is the legislature going to be dancing in place? Is that what you're suggesting?
Treading water might be a better phrase, but dancing in place is good, too. I think they're going to – everyone's in a wait-and-see mode. The governor said earlier this week that, as Yogi Berra once said, it's going to get late early. The deadline for a lot of cuts has come and gone. The governor's office has been kind of making incremental cuts to local governments. But if the feds don't step in soon, some hard decisions are going to have to be made. And the governor and the legislative leaders have both said that those would be very painful, on the order of 20% cuts to schools and things like that. So I think you're in the next couple of weeks, you're going to see a conclusion to this drama one way or another.
Do you think we're going to see a lot of anger? I mean, you got the Senate, the Assembly, you got the governor. This is a governor who knows how to fight when he has to. And some of these people in the legislature are going to be sure to try to take it out on the governor. There could be some real fireworks here, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think obviously the governor has an upper hand in budget negotiations and generally gets what he wants through that negotiation period. And the assembly and the Senate tend to have a little bit more sway outside of the budget. But, you know, because of the financial crisis and because of the way the budget was set up with this ability of the executive branch to basically make cuts or suggest cuts as the year goes on, the budget season is going to last 12 months this year. It will not stop until the state actually has a clearer sense of money and how they're going to pay for everything. And even, you know, going into next year when we don't know what the status on the coronavirus is going to be, we don't know if there'll be a vaccine, when you're going to have a lot of new members coming in, particularly on the assembly side, you know, it's going to be a fraught year, I think, 2021.
As you mentioned this, Jesse McKinley of the New York Times, what's been interesting with some of the election results is that some progressives have been ousting some of the longest-serving people. I see Lentol. I was a baby when Lentol went to the legislature, and I'm 79 years old. That's a joke. But he's been here a long, long time, and out he goes to a new progressive type, and he's not alone.
Yeah, and I'm not being ageist here, but I actually was a baby when Joe Lentol got elected to the Assembly in 1972. He has been here for almost a half a century, and of all the results that have been coming in, that was the one that just that surprised me the most. I mean, Joe Lentol is pretty much a fixture in North Brooklyn. He's, you know, he is the kind of guy who you would expect to be, you know, secure in any other year. But as you point out, there is a real energy in the left wing of the Democratic Party right now. And for lack of a better word, you know, progressive, I think, gets tossed around a lot. Yeah. You know, to be even more precise, a lot of these candidates who won primaries in June, they were Democratic socialists. You know, these are people that ascribe to the Bernie Sanders kind of socialist wing of this party, and they are winning elections. And, you know, I think that a couple of years ago in 2018, when the Democrats took the Senate, those candidates were riding this kind of wave of anti-Trump, you know, let's elect a bunch of Democrats to show our displeasure with the president. But this year, you know, it's Democrat on Democrat, you know, primaries. And in this case, it's not really a rejection of Trump. It seems to be more a rejection of kind of centrism, you know, that the progressives really want to bend the party both statewide and nationally further to the left. And they are winning elections and making their point at the ballot box that these are popular ideas. So it'll be curious to see how those elections turn into legislating next year.
I guess the smiling face behind the mirror is AOC Cortez, who obviously is endorsing a lot of these people.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, she has proven that she can back a winner. When you look at the congressional elections, you know, the victory of Jamal Bowman in the 16th district, that's just another example of, you know, Elliot Engel, not unlike Joe Lentol, had been in the legislature, in this case, the U.S. Congress, for decades. And along came a challenger that really had the right rhetoric, that had the right moment, that seemed to have the right politics, that really got primary voters charged up. And Jamal Bowman beat Elliot Engel by a good margin, not only in the Bronx, but also in Westchester County. So, you know, they are that wing of the party is winning elections.
And yet Joe Biden won in New York State. But of course, it was all decided by the time we got there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with that, you're maybe seeing a little bit more pragmatic approach from some Democrats, you know, where they do have a common enemy, it would seem, in Donald Trump, that they desperately want to get him out of the White House. And Biden seems to have solidified his campaign at the right moment and kind of pushed aside Bernie Sanders and seems to be riding pretty high in the polls right now, though, of course, you know, 2020 being what it is, I'm never going to make a prediction on in any sort of race because politics has gotten so quicksilver and so unpredictable.
Now, the governor has been praised for his handling of the coronavirus, but he has taken some real substantial hits over nursing homes and his handling of nursing homes. Let me ask you this. Is that a fair hit? Do you think that's a fair way to judge this governor? He said he was taking his advice from CDC and others. Is he vulnerable there?
Well, I won't comment on the value judgment of this, but I'll simply say something that you know as well as anyone is that politics is not fair, you know. So whether or not the criticisms are fair or not is kind of beside the point. The Republicans have found a way now to attack Cuomo, whose national popularity or national profile, at least, have gone through the roof. His state popularity is well, you know, into the 60s and in the 70s in some polls. So Republicans, both on a state level and on a federal level, have been looking for a way to get under Andrew Cuomo's skin and to get under his political carapace. You know, they want to ding this guy. And the way that they have been able to ding him, or at least distract him, is by attacking him on nursing homes. And, you know, myself and Luis Ferre had a story this morning in the paper that basically shows that, you know, the Republicans continue to kind of hammer him on this, and he continues to push back. But the fact that the issue is not going away, that it was not settled by this Department of Health report that came out in early July, shows that it seems to have some staying power as a political talking point for right and Republican politicians, vis-a-vis Andrew Cuomo. And I don't think that's going away anytime soon. I could see that dogging him through next year and through a reelection campaign in 2022.
You know, Jesse McKinley, I can tell you one thing about Andrew Cuomo. I was on the air with him yesterday, as we speak, and having a long talk with him. And at one point, he was being very funny, I think. I liked it. But he listed everything I had ever said, written, or done that was counter to his reelection or to his continuance. I wonder, you know, is this a guy who just doesn't forget, does he?
Well, I think he also reads the papers and listens to the radio and watches television. I think he is keenly aware of his public persona and his public popularity and what's being written about him, both in a positive light and, of course, in a negative light. And keep in mind, too, that Cuomo is he loves polls. You know, this is a guy that privately polls on a bunch of issues. Bill Mahoney from Politico made a great little catch a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, that the governor spent $70,000 on polling during the coronavirus outbreak. And we don't know what those questions were. We don't know what he was asking. But it shows that the governor is constantly aware and constantly keeping track of how popular he is and how popular his decisions are. So, yeah, this is a guy who's absolutely aware of what you're saying about him and will certainly, as you know, as well as I do, make it known if he thinks it's unfair.
I actually enjoyed the repartee. Let's talk a little bit about the K-12 schools and whether they're going to reopen in the fall. Now, he says the numbers in New York State are basically very good, best in the nation. He keeps bragging about that. And I said, well, if they stay that way, then you're going to open the schools, right? And he basically said, right. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the decision on that is going to be made in early August. I think he said from August 1st to August 7th. And I think by the metrics that he rolled out, I think the schools will be open. But once again, that comes with a giant asterisk. You know, in this whole ordeal, one thing that has guided decisions has been kind of regionality, for lack of a better word, that, you know, in certain parts of upstate, there have been relatively few cases, relatively few deaths. And so there seems to be a different set of rules for certain parts of the state. So I could see a scenario where, you know, schools in less hard hit regions actually have 5 days a week, whereas schools in, say, the capital region or other places, Erie County, where they've had more cases, might be on some sort of modified hybrid schedule. And I could also see a scenario where some places that are seeing flare-ups would see schools just go online only. But New York is, in this regard, a little bit lucky, if you can call a terrible tragedy luck, just in the timing of this. You know, keep in mind that New York's deaths peaked in April. They've been steadily declining. Hospitalizations have been declining. Positive results, while they're hanging at about 1%, are not anywhere near what they're seeing in places like Florida, where you're talking 15% or more. So in New York, the bad apex has passed. And so conceivably, when schools start up in September, it would seem as though school boards would have more opportunity as well as good positive signs to kind of reopen classrooms. So, but once again, he says that that decision is not going to happen until the beginning of August.
Of course, he's got to find some money, because if they open the schools and they want to keep people separated and they want to keep people safe and they want the right kind of nurses and things, they're going to have to find the money to do all of that at a time when there is no money.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. And you know, the other kind of calculus in a lot of this is going to be whether or not the teachers' unions are okay with coming back into the classroom. And there have been a lot of teachers who have spoken out, both in New York and elsewhere, saying they don't feel comfortable going back in the classrooms, that they don't feel that they're worried about their own safety and their children's safety. And keep in mind, too, that these schools will also have to take into account the health of people like, you know, cafeteria workers and bus drivers and custodial workers and other people who work in schools and may be of an age, you know, where they are more vulnerable to this disease. So all of those calculations will go into it. But I do think that some New York schools will have, almost full schedules, albeit with, you know, social distancing and temperature checks and masks for students and teachers and things like that. So if you're a parent, I think, particularly if you're upstate, there is some hope that, that kids will go back to school.
So now Cuomo has, to you, to me, to others, talked about the second virus, the second wave. That's got to be pretty much on his mind. One time I talked to him, I thought it was going to be there tomorrow. He was so definitive that it was going to happen. In subsequent conversations, he hasn't seemed to be that assiduous in his insistence.
Well, that first of all, that is a fantastic vocabulary word. Assiduous is one of my favorites. Semi-scrambling for my dictionary. But yeah, I mean, I think the constant fear for Cuomo and other state officials and officials in New Jersey and Connecticut is that, you know, having paid this terrible price and the number of deaths and the number of severely sick people, that they could conceivably see a second wave. And so I think Cuomo has, you know, he keeps a very close eye on those numbers and really does not want to see that happen. But then also at the same time seems to acknowledge that, you know, this virus is very tricky and it you know, it's still being studied and still being understood. And, you know, I think they're worried that it will come back. Hence, you know, the quarantine order and stuff like that to kind of keep travelers kind of under locks once they get back to New York. So, you know, with all of this, it's kind of a waiting game, an assiduous waiting game, but a waiting game nonetheless.
Good use. Mrs. Nahum, my teacher, my Spanish teacher, said, Shatak, what you always want to do when you're answering a question is use the words that were in the question to make your answer. Don't you see? Okay, I want to ask you about absentee ballots. How's all that going in New York State?
Well, it has been slow. Let's put it that way. We wrote a story in the Times last week about this. We're a month to the day from the presidential primary as well as the other primaries that were held around the state on June 23rd. And some of those races have not been called. And when you talk to election officials, particularly in New York City, they say, look, we're doing this as quickly as we can. It's a very, you know, labor intensive process. But I think the most critical element with absentee ballots to remember is that in most elections, absentee ballots only make up about 5 to 7% of the total of ballots. And oftentimes they're not even counted, particularly if it's a blowout, they're not counted immediately. You know, unless it's a very close race, they aren't definitive or determinative. In this case, however, in this election cycle, in this primary cycle, in some races, it was 40%, 50%, 60% of the ballots were absentee. So these offices, which had never handled anywhere near this number of ballots, was suddenly using old systems, old ways of kind of verifying that the voter was the voter, that the voter signature matched, the voter done everything correctly. They're having to use these old systems to handle just this enormous swell of absentee ballots. And that, unfortunately, takes time. And I think most people, were patient for a couple of weeks. But now that we're a month down the road, I talking to campaigns, they're chomping at the bit to get results and move from primary into general election campaigns.
Sure like to know whether Carolyn Maloney, for example, the congresswoman from the East Side, won or lost. And we just have no clue.
We do not know.
Okay, so let me ask you about the census. We've talked about this before, you and I, but there's a lot at stake here. There's money at stake, how much money comes back to New York, but there's also congressional seats. What are you hearing about all of that?
Well, it's a good point, and I think that coronavirus has upset the apple cart there as well. And I think the last numbers I saw was they were getting about 60% response on census, which, of course, is really low and not particularly promising. I think that New York probably would lose a congressional seat anyway, just because the population has basically been stagnant. But if people don't fill out the forms, if the census takers aren't able to go door to door, if they're not able to kind of get the number right, then New York will be in a bad way, particularly considering Trump's, demand that he's going to sign an executive order that's going to prevent immigrants or undocumented aliens from being counted in the census. That may not be constitutional, but that is a threat nonetheless. And that could conceivably, I think advocates would say, hold down the number of undocumented immigrants who are counted. And that in turn might hurt, New York showing in the census and in turn hurt how many congressional seats they have.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if he gets away with it, if Trump gets away with it. However, you take a look at that situation, begin to think it out and say, okay, what's he really doing? Okay, somebody comes from a Latin American country, staying with relatives. You think those relatives are going to open the door for the census? Probably not. And if he puts the heat on, that's another reason New York will not do well in the census.
Yeah, and I think just to extend that kind of line of thought, the president has certainly not been shy in recent weeks about using federal agents to go into cities and threatened to do so in New York City. So the Mr. Trump is not shy about using kind of federal might, as it were, to enforce policy. And even if it is just a scare tactic, I think that for people that are, trying to get an accurate count, this just complicates their lives.
So Jesse McKinley of The New York Times, the redistricting hearings, that's the straw that will break the New York GOP, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think the New York GOP is having a hard time of it. They certainly suffered catastrophic losses in 2018 because the Senate got taken back by the Democrats. And I think if you talk to Republican consultants, Trump at the top of the ticket in 2020 is not exactly making them, optimistic for their chances in a year in which you can imagine a lot of Democrats are going to come out to kind of try to elect Joe Biden. So that being said, Nick Langworthy, who is the party chair of Republicans, has been outspoken on a lot of issues. He's a younger guy. He's been trying to kind of, whip up the base in the state Senate. They've got Rob Ort as the new Senate majority leader, who is also kind of a fiery and somewhat charismatic politician. So, the Republicans do have some firepower, but right now just the demographics of the state, Democrats outnumbering Republicans 2-1, it just does not bode well for statewide elections, although they might be able to win some kind of more local stuff, on the Senate side.
So let me ask you real fast, Jesse McKinley, because we are running out of time. Elise Stefanik, did she tie herself to the president too early?
Well, that we shall see in November, right? I mean, Stefanik was I think considered by some to be somewhat of a more moderate Republican when she was first elected. But as you point out, she has banked hard right, and she has really tied her fortunes to Donald Trump, so much so that there were rumors, afloat that she could potentially, take over for Mike Pence as a vice presidential candidate or something like that. I don't think that's going to happen. But she has certainly cast her lot with Donald Trump and his popularity in that North Country region where her congressional district is. I believe her opponent is Tedra Cobb, who ran against her before. And you know, that district is tough sailing for Democrats. There's not, the Republicans have been pretty comfortable up there for about the last 6-8 years. And Stefanik has easily held off Tedra Cobb 2 years ago. So it might be a long shot for Democrats, but it will certainly be a referendum on Donald Trump's popularity in that district vis-a-vis Elise Stefanik.
A lot of people are thinking that Cuomo may end up in a Biden administration. He won't run for a fourth term like his father did. And, you know, maybe attorney general. What do you make of that?
I think that is the one position that might intrigue him. He has served, obviously, in the Clinton cabinet. You know, he knows what federal cabinet positions look like. Attorney general is a big job, and he certainly was attorney general in the state of New York. I guess it just hypothetically, conceivably, he could do that. But I also think that the governor has, you know, still harbors some presidential ambitions. And I think that particularly concerning the ride that he's had with coronavirus, and concerning the fact that if Joe Biden were elected president, he could conceivably be a one-term guy. 2024 may not be beyond Cuomo's thinking at this point. But once again, you know, that's a long way off, and I can't see 4 months in the future, let alone 4 years.
We're out of time. Our guest has been Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ella.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.